I walked across the country. That was really my boost. The thing that made me say I used to be a concerned citizen, now I'm a climate action warrior. It was the people on that march, and it was everywhere from a 3-year-old to a 90-year-old. They didn't do the whole thing. Hardly anybody did the whole thing. We marched for 8 months, 3,000 miles from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. I was one of 4 people who walked every step, and I was the only woman, and I was the oldest.
Hello and welcome. As always, I'm Abby. This is Stories Lived, Stories Told. And today, I invite you to join me in revisiting our conversation with Miriam Kashia, where we take a communication perspective on climate action. To take a communication perspective is to consider what we're making and how we're making it through our communication practices. This means we look closely at patterns, context, stories, and relationships, and that we use curiosity, mindfulness, collaboration, and dialogue to create better social worlds. Whether the topic of today's conversation is familiar to you or not, the hope is that using a communication perspective will reveal new ways of seeing and being. At the top of the episode, you heard our conversation partner today, Miriam Kashia. Miriam is a self-proclaimed climate action warrior. She's involved with 100 Grannies for a Livable Future. And in 2014, at the age of 71, she participated in the Great March for Climate Action, where she walked over 3,000 miles across the United States. She was named a climate hero by The Guardian's Down to Earth Environmental Newsletter in 2022, and she was also featured in the Race to Save the World documentary. As we revisit this conversation, which was originally published in September 2022, I invite you to pay attention to how this conversation hits you differently and what new wisdom you hear that you might have missed before. I've chosen to share this conversation again in hopes that it can provide some context for this sustainability series, especially because two of our other conversation partners this month, Mark Edwards, who you've already met, and Sakawis Nobis, who we will hear from next week, are friends of Miriam, and she's the reason that we got connected. Also, the work that Miriam has been doing for a long time and that we spoke about in this conversation in 2022 is still so relevant, so I wanted to bring it back to our attention again to revisit. I'm hoping that this can reignite your own desire to participate in climate action efforts, whatever it may be. Okay, so let's continue the conversation with Miriam. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Stories Lived, Stories Told. Today, we are talking to a very special guest, Miriam Kashia. Welcome, and thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Abby. It's really a pleasure to be here. I've been looking forward to this, and let's just do it. I've got stories.
Perfect. We're excited to hear your stories. So the first question that I usually ask my guests is some version of who are you, or what is the story you tell about yourself? And to give a little bit of context for you, I wanted to ask a question like this, because in a lot of podcasts I hear different interviews or conversations, I would maybe read a bio about you and tell people who you are and list maybe some achievements of yours. But instead of doing that, I would rather have you tell us who you are based on what's important to you. So, Miriam, what is the story that you are telling about yourself?
I was raised in a Methodist parsonage. So I had a very wonderful upbringing, large family, 5 children. And I like to say I was well-churched. And that was a huge part of my childhood. I've changed spiritually since then, but I'm not going to go into that.
Sure.
So that was my foundation. And I honor and respect and appreciate those values. That's the core of who I am still today. Shift ahead. Went to college. Got married after 2 years. Had 2 children. Boy and a girl. And after 9 years of marriage, decided I got married too young at age 19, and we had discovered that we really were not all that compatible in terms of our values and beliefs. So we split, and I was a single parent for a while. Then I had a second, very brief marriage, and decided that wasn't my appropriate route in life either. So I've been single now for about 40 years. And that's worked well for me. Raising children, two children with very little support, financial support, and working full time and trying to finish my education at night school and helping run the Boy Scouts. I mean, it was a lot of work.
Yeah.
I got through it. I finally finished my undergraduate degree, having gone to about five different colleges when I was 39. And when I was 42, I launched into a graduate program at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in California. And that was a life changer. And then I got another master's degree from the University of Iowa in social work, clinical social work, because I wanted to be a therapist. I always wanted to be a therapist. My earlier career working for General Motors Acceptance Corporation in accounting was never who I was, but I had to do that, provide for my children. So that's the early part of my life. That was really the tough part that I had to get through. So that's the story of challenges faced and mostly surmounted. And I feel okay about that. I never had enough time for my children. That part I regret. So after I got my master's degree in counseling, I opened a private practice here in Iowa City and saw clients for a number of years. I always wanted to go to the Peace Corps, which, as we know, was founded by JFK in 1961. And I never had the opportunity to do it when I was young because I was busy, all this other stuff.
A little busy.
So when I was 62, I decided to apply to the Peace Corps.
Wow.
And after I was accepted, I spent a year closing my practice. It's not something that you give 2 weeks notice and walk
right
out. So I spent a year closing my practice and I went to Namibia in Africa for 2 years with the Peace Corps. Another life-changing event. Well, the Peace Corps calls it the hardest job you'll ever love.
And you found that to be true?
I definitely found that to be true. So after 2 years in the Peace Corps, I came back home. And oh my goodness, I had not given much thought to what's next. So I spent a couple of years doing part-time work in an organization that did in-home support for elderly or disabled people. I did some nanny work. Actually, that was interesting for a couple, both of whom were professors at the University of Iowa. And I took care of their two little kids for about 3 years. Then I did some gigs volunteering for the government at state parks and national parks. And that was a lot of fun and interesting. But I kept wanting something really to dig into. And one of my gigs for the parks was in Alaska at a state park, a historical park. And I drove up there by myself and I drove home. And on the way home, I was doing this discernment process, this inner searching and thinking about and, okay, what am I going to do with the rest of my energy, my resources, my passions, my skills? What do I really want to commit to? Because I was doing too many things and I knew I was spread too thin and I wanted to focus. So about the time I got to Denver, coming back from Alaska, I came to the decision, a really deeply considered decision, that I wanted to devote the rest of my life to two things. Number one being my spiritual life, which had evolved over time.
Right.
It continues to evolve. And secondly, to the climate crisis. And that relieved me of feeling torn in so many directions about all the other things that are so important to me and all the other values I have about social justice and so on and so forth. But what I didn't take under consideration was how broad, deep, and complex the climate crisis is. It's been challenging to find my path through that, and it's ongoing. That is still where my passion, my energy, my resources such as they are, and my time and my skills such as they are, that's where they go. In addition, of course, to my family, friends, and the things that round me out as a whole person. Is that enough?
That's wonderful. I really appreciate hearing that. And yeah, even back to the very first thing you said, I can relate to having maybe a really positive upbringing in a church. I was raised Presbyterian, but kind of having a spiritual change away from that, but still really appreciating those values and knowing that that's a huge part of who I am. And so I appreciate you, you know, being able to articulate it that way, because it feels like, especially around Christianity, people kind of say, you're either in it or you're not, or you love it or you hate it. But there's, I think it's a very complicated relationship. But I can see too how your spiritual life and working to fight against climate change can go hand in hand, because to me, I think it's all of the naturally existing things that I can find in the world that make me feel connected to a sense of spirituality, because it's just all very beautiful is the way that I see it. So I wonder if those two are connected in that way for you also.
Absolutely. In fact, I find a lot of my spiritual sustenance in nature. Mm-hmm. I pointedly go there as much as I can.
Yeah. I can see maybe what I would call different chapters of your life emerging in the way that you tell your story. What's it like now being able to look back and kind of notice where those chapters are and reflect on that?
That's an interesting question. And I have two different answers for that. I try not to dwell in the past because mm-hmm. there was a lot of pain and hardship.
Yeah.
And some trauma that I have no need to talk about, which is one of the reasons I don't look back a lot, because I mm-hmm. don't find that nourishes me now. But I do also recognize that all the things that I did and all the hardships and trauma that I endured created the person I am. Not just those in themselves, but how I chose to work through them, deal with them, and surpass some of that difficulty, all of that difficulty.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the phrases that I really hate is everything happens for a reason. But I think if you maybe dig into that phrase and find a little more nuance when you are not dwelling in the past, but are able to reflect on how you got to where you are, there's some value to me in trying to understand how everything worked together to get you where you are today.
Yeah.
Where you are today is one of those roles is self-described climate action warrior. And so as I kind of explained about CMM, one of those tools is the DAISY model. And so that's really, if the center of the DAISY is your role as a climate action warrior, then I wonder if you could put into words what we would call the petals of that DAISY. So what are all the pieces of context? So maybe the chapters in your life that led you there, or the individuals you interacted with, or the things that you valued. So if we were looking at your role as a climate action warrior, as a DAISY, what do you see as the petals that contributed to that?
Wow. I think I already talked about my love of nature and my appreciation for nature. And that means all of nature, not just the pretty sunsets and the fir trees and the rabbits and squirrels.
Where did that start?
That started with my upbringing. I lived in a small rural community in Iowa and spent all our time outdoors. That's when kids used to go outside in the morning and come in at night, time to have supper and go to bed, It was really free and fun. And we just roamed and did whatever we wanted. And we went on family vacations. We didn't have any money, but we went camping. And some parishioners loaned us their cabin on a lovely little lake in Minnesota. And I got exposed to nature in those ways. And my parents respected nature. So that's one petal.
Sure. Absolutely.
Another petal is I was always interested in what was happening in our country and in the world that had to do with nature. So I read books. I was a long-term member of the Sierra Club, and I would get their magazines. So I knew things were changing, and I knew some of the problems that were evolving, and I paid attention. Mm-hmm. So that was, even in my busy, complex, demanding life, I was still paying attention. And that's another pedal. The other pedal was I love being outdoors. I'm an outdoor adventurer. I bicycle. I kayak, I canoe, I cross-country ski and snowshoe. If it happens outdoors and doesn't cost money, I do it. Hiking, camping, all of it.
Yeah.
So that's a really big pedal for me. That was, and always will be, a great part of who I am and how I live in the world. I'm almost 80 now. A few months I will be. And I'm slowing down. Yeah, it's true. But I still challenge myself, and it's harder and harder to get in and out of a kayak, but I still do it.
That's good.
And I recently got an e-bike so I can make it up some of those hills more easily, but I still ride my old bike.
Mm-hmm.
So the nature part is a huge pedal. The pedal of community. And I would include my family and my friends in that, but also the community of people from my church community and from the activism community. And those disparate communities fill different needs for me. And I can get from one what I don't get from another. And by get, I mean, it helps me to be a whole person and live in a balanced way. And I have some friends that are not in any way part of my activist life. But when we get together, we laugh uproariously and play silly games. And they're people I used to work with when I had my practice. And they're just as important to me as my climate action friends with my new actions. You know, it's part of the balance.
Absolutely.
Let's see, is that enough pedals or have
I got? Yeah, I wonder, you're talking about, you know, your community you found. Are there individuals or other climate activists that you look up to or looked up to and made you want to engage in that more?
I found most of those early on in what I read. And later, when I started becoming more active, they were people that I worked with, that I was engaged with in this work. Without naming a lot of names, I walked across the country. That was really my boost. The thing that made me say I used to be a concerned citizen, now I'm a climate action warrior. It was the people on that march, and it was everywhere from a 3-year-old to a 90-year-old. They didn't do the whole thing. Hardly anybody did the whole thing. We marched for 8 months, 3,000 miles from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. I was one of four people who walked every step, and I was the only woman, and I was the oldest.
Wow.
So a lot of what I did was walk.
Right.
Through blizzards and storms and heat waves and hailstorms, you name it, we walked. So some of those people I'm still very connected with, and they are heroes to me, and I learned a lot. And here's a story. The young people on that march, and there were a number of them who had taken a year off college to do this march or who were between high school and college or were still in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And they came, some of them came for the whole thing. Others just came for a month or 3 months or 2 weeks, whatever they could. And they started becoming impatient because what we were doing was walking and stopping in communities and having potluck suppers in church basements or having somebody go and talk in the schools. And so we were doing a lot of walking and talking. And these young people were eager for more. So they started pushing the envelope, what I would call stepping outside my comfort zone box. And they started doing lie-ins. When we got to Chicago, they did one in front of, I don't remember what building it was, but some finance company, I don't know, that was supporting fossil fuel extraction. And then we came to a facility that was actually a petroleum company. It was a refinery. There you go.
Sure. Yes.
And they laid down and blocked an entryway so the trucks couldn't come in and go. Now, this was, for me, outside of the box. And I was a mayor, by the way. I was elected 3 times to be the mayor of this little group we called the One Earth Village. Mm-hmm. And there was an average group of about 35 of us, although all in all, I think well over 150 people participated. But anyway, so they're lying on the ground and Miriam is getting a little upset because this is trouble. This could be trouble. This could crash our whole march if some of us end up in jail and so on. So I went up to them and I kept saying, this isn't who we are. This isn't what we do. And they eventually left before the police arrived. But for the duration of the march, they gently and persistently helped me understand that resistance and dissent are one of our big tools. They aren't the only tool, but historically, they're very powerful. If you look back at the women's, you know, right to vote, and you look back at the civil rights movement and so on and so forth, they happened when people took to the streets.
Right.
So that helped shift me from a concerned citizen doing everything in a nice way to a climate action warrior.
It's interesting to me the way you're talking about it, saying that this march that you did for 8 months is what shifted you to a climate action warrior, because I would think that most concerned citizens wouldn't go on an 8 month march to begin with. I would think you would already have to be a climate action warrior in some way.
Well, I was on the verge. And I'll just throw this out. I was recently given an honor by The Guardian's Down to Earth environmental newsletter. I was proclaimed a climate hero a couple of weeks ago. And here's something they said in the write-up they did about me. And this was a quote: "The pressure to step outside my comfort zone and actually do something was starting to feel explosive. I needed to do it, and I needed to do it now. But I didn't have a clue what or how." And the what turned out to be this link I saw for the Great March for Climate Action. And I was ripe, eager, and ready, and I signed up right now. And that experience, walking across the country, is what converted me. We walked past the refineries and the extraction and the polluted rivers, and we talked to people in the sacrifice zones who were suffering from all of this. And I mean, it was an extraordinary effort and an extraordinary experience. And so what I learned and what I did and what those kids taught me is really what helped me turn into a climate action warrior and helped me determine that that was going to be my life. Well, I'd already decided that when I drove back from Alaska, but this gave me more background in the how.
Was this your first event that you were participating in such a way for activism for climate change?
The first big one. Yeah. And when we got to Ohio, there was a huge march in New York City. It was called the People's Climate March. And it was a huge, big, the first really major climate protest there had ever been. And so we chartered a bus, took it to New York City, spent 3 days there participating in the march, and then took the bus back home, back to Ohio, and continued our own march. Another couple of months till we got to Washington. That event was also amazing. There were 500,000 people on that march.
Yeah.
And it was exciting. It was extraordinary. People of all makes and models and colors and backgrounds and signs. And it was really energizing and gave us a boost to help us finish our own. Because here we were, the sort of ragtag little group.
Right.
Finding our way across the country.
It makes a lot of sense to me that you say, you know, your heroes around climate activism are the people that you know and that you've interacted with. You know, it's one thing to see faces that are famous or have some kind of status speaking up and hearing what they have to say, but really engaging with people and seeing their passion up front and firsthand, I think would be really powerful.
Yeah, and I could name authors of books, you know, Jim Hansen, Bill McKibben, et cetera, et cetera. And they helped form me and move me in the direction. But I had to step outside my box. I had to take that step. I had to realize that I needed to do everything I could do. And so the people around me were doing that. And that gave me the impetus to join the ranks and take the leap.
And now, how do you feel about being called a climate hero?
Well, it's a little daunting. I'm honored. I'm humbled. And I know dozens and dozens of people who deserve that honor who probably won't ever get it. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, somebody that I know from the Dakota Access Pipeline resistance movement that I was involved with here after that climate march nominated me. And he should be the one who got, you know, walking across the country gave me a ticket to talk and a ticket to be listened to. It was a big thing, especially at 71 years old. And I've probably given 50 talks. When I got back from the march, the local newspaper, the Iowa City Press Citizen, interviewed me and put a picture of me on the front page of the paper. And I said in that interview, I'll talk to anybody, anytime, anywhere. About climate. And I jokingly say, now be careful what you say.
Right. People really took you up on that.
take me up on it. And I've talked to groups of six, and I've talked to groups of 150, you know, the Rotary Club, whatever. Mm-hmm. And that has slowed down, but I still get, because of the march and my actions since, I still get called on a lot to speak up. And I do.
Yeah. That's wonderful. I think what you said about you learned from those young people that wanted to maybe make a little more noise than you were ready to. There's a lot of value in that, and you were able to learn. But I think what is important that I see is the talking that you said that you were doing in all of these communities. And now the platform that you have to be able to continue talking, because I think action is, of course, important for fighting social injustices. But before that, I think comes the talking, the conversation, and giving people the language to understand what's happening and what needs to be done and what they can do to participate in it.
You talked about intergenerational connection and how valuable that was. And that has been. Young Greta Thunberg came to Iowa City, and there was 10,000 people, or I don't know how many thousand, but in sure. downtown Iowa City to hear her. And the Grannies, this 100 Grannies for a Livable Future group that I'm a part of here, where I do a lot of my action work with them, were on the stage with her.
Among, wow.
You know, the mayor and the other dignitaries. And so we got our picture taken with Greta. Her presence and her work in the world has been phenomenal. And that's a segue into something else. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, I attended a 3-day seminar. It was called a summit, the Climate Action Summit in Des Moines. And it was put on by a group called Buffalo Rebellion. And it was a phenomenal experience, Abby, because it included an organized immigrant group, the Black Liberation Movement. They changed the name from Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. which is a Des Moines group. It included the Sierra Club, and it included all these indigenous groups, the Great Plains Action Society, which is an indigenous organization fighting for climate justice. And I'm a personal friend of the woman who started that and directs it. I was invited to this summit, and I went, and it was extraordinary. For all these days, each group had the floor, their voices were heard, everybody was on an equal plane. And during that summit, what just got me was hearing people of color say out loud, "This is the first time I've ever been to this kind of event where I felt completely safe." So, I am looking through my church group, which is called Green Sanctuary. Our sub team that's involved in environmental work to create an working ally group with the Great Plains Action Society, and seeing how we can support their work. Not, "Will you please come to our events?
Yes,
because you know how to do this, and we'd like to, you know, have your face show up with us. We want to support them."
That's incredible. Yeah, that's a huge difference between those two things.
Consciousness. It really is. And by God, we need to do it.
Absolutely.
I'm jumping all over here.
No, that's perfect. It's perfect. Don't worry about it. I was going to say right now would be a good time to bring up a question I wanted to ask, which is, can you talk about how you view the need for climate action through the lens of intersectionality?
Yes, I can speak to that. And that's actually a word I learned on the climate march. It was a new word. It wasn't very much in the public discourse yet, but I learned what it was, and I use it a lot. Another way to put that word is something that Thich Nhat Hanh, one of my spiritual mentors, calls interbeing, which is another way of saying the same thing. And I like both words, and I think that they together, I think they make a complete thought. Intersectionality means to me that all injustice is connected. And so if somebody's working on issues with Black Lives Matter or Indigenous or you know, jobs, whatever, housing, and I'm working on climate, it's still all connected. So that's what intersectionality means to me. All injustice is connected. And interbeing, it means the same thing, but for me, it goes a little deeper. It goes a lot deeper. It means for me, and apparently for Thich Nhat Hanh, it means that at the core, we are whole and we are one. Simply put.
I think it's powerful for me to hear the story that you talk about of people that maybe are a part of marginalized identities, being able to be in that space that you were in and say that I feel safe here. And this is the first time, because that's a big part of the coordinated management of meaning theory, is that we do all of this storytelling, but something we have to consider is that not everyone's stories are given the same privilege to be heard. Not everyone feels safe to share their stories or to feel heard. And so I just really value creating a space like that. And so it's really cool to see that you were able to be a part of a space like that as well.
And will continue to be, by the way.
Absolutely.
So here's a little subset of that experience, which ties into what you just said, Abby. One of the things that someone over that 3 days, probably an Indigenous person who was presenting, mentioned. They mentioned Greta, and they talked about the work she has done and how fabulous that's been and how great it is that she's done what she's done and what an impact it's had globally. And then they said, but you know, we have Indigenous young people who have done that work for a long time and have done amazing things. And they get no attention. They get no press. They get no global heroic response. And that caught me up short, because it's absolutely true. And not just Indigenous kids, but all kinds of young Black people or, you know, whoever.
Mm-hmm.
From Namibia, for Pete's sakes, where I was with them.
Right. Before. You saw it. Yeah.
Lots of things. So Greta's great, yeah, but we certainly need to recognize others.
From other voices. Yeah.
Other voices, right. Well, we were fighting the Dakota Access Pipeline, which originated in North Dakota and went across South Dakota and Iowa and into Nebraska to be shipped to the Gulf and exported from a fracking facility in North Dakota. We fought that for a couple of years, we being a coalition here in Iowa. During that time, you undoubtedly heard about Standing Rock. Standing Rock was and remains a phenomenal Indigenous renaissance. It was up in North Dakota along Lake Oahe, which was the water source for the Sioux tribes that live in there, the Lakota, the Dakota, and others. They started a camp to resist this pipeline being built under their water and under the Missouri River, by the way, to try to prevent it because it threatened their water source and right. their sacred lands and their ancestral mm-hmm. burial grounds. Okay, that's the background, which you probably already knew. I went up to Standing Rock 3 times. Once when it was just a little tiny community with about 6 or 8 tents and a lean-to for a kitchen and one teepee. I went up there to testify at the one and only hearing that was given to the Lakota people before the pipeline permit was issued. Then I went up again a few months later, where there were 10,000 people camped along Lake Oahe. And that was the most phenomenal experience, Abby. These huge communities of people from all over the world. I met people from Norway and Africa and South America who were there to support what the American Indigenous people were trying to do. And
wow.
The renaissance of connectivity and culture was just amazing. And here again, I was a witness. I was not a leader. I was not one of the ones who spoke. I just was there to support and listen. And the third time I went was in early November, and I remember exactly because I was in my tent sleeping the night after the election when Donald Trump was elected. And I got up in the morning and crawled out of my tent, and I didn't know who had won. I walked to the top of what they called Media Hill, which was high enough that people could get some connection on their phones and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I saw a friend, and I could tell from the look on her face what had happened. And I fell into her arms crying. And she took me by the hand and took me down to the circle around the sacred fire, which was a fire that was kept 24/7, tended and protected and used for ritual purposes. And there's a large circle of people around it. And there was drumming. And anyway, somebody came up to me that I knew. I volunteered in the mental first aid teepee because I was a therapist and they mm-hmm. needed people to help people who were being traumatized by the yes. police, dogs and so forth on the front lines. She came up to me and saw how much distress I was in. And she said to me, and I can't say this without crying, and I've said it 100 times if I've said it once. She said to me, "Miriam, I just spoke to one of the elders and I want you to know what he said to me. He said, 'Today we will dance and we will drum and we will sing and we will not give in to the fear, because it is fear that feeds the darkness.'" And I think that is prophetic for our time. Mm-hmm. We will not give in to the fear, because that's what feeds the darkness.
Well, I certainly see your work as a climate action warrior as bringing in the light. I think it's really important. So I appreciate the work that you do and the passion that you seem to bring to the work that you do as well.
Thank you, Abby. When I got the award from the Guardian, the Climate Hero Award, I wrote a little response to it and sent it out to people that I knew who I didn't think would see it. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, you know, I do this work for the fame and fortune." I jokingly said that.
Right.
And then I put parenthetically, "And I'm still waiting for the fortune."
Right, right. Well, I'm curious because, well, you are officially a climate hero. I don't want to put you on a pedestal in a way that, you know, makes your story or makes you seem less of a complete human being, because you are. And so I'm curious, in addition to your role as a climate action warrior, what are the other roles and relationships that are most important to you? So, you know, maybe your time as a therapist or your time in the Peace Corps, other relationships that are important to your life now or in the past?
Thank you for that question, because I really try to be a whole person. It isn't always easy because my work as an activist is extremely demanding. And as I said, I'll talk to anybody anytime, anywhere about it. But I do have a life.
Absolutely.
I live in the Chicago area, and I don't see them often, but we're in contact. I'm especially close to my daughter. And, you know, I have a church community that I'm a part of. I'm a Unitarian Universalist, and I embrace that faith because I'm free to bring my own spiritual journey and my own beliefs to the table and respect everybody else's. And I value their principles and values and social justice work that we do in the world. So I'm a strong part of that community. My sister lives nearby and she has some medical challenges. I support her and see her frequently. I jokingly say we have played 2 trillion games of Rummy Cube since COVID started. And I have a strong circle of friends, many here in where I live in Johnson County, where Iowa City is, and many spread across the country. I love to brag that I have wonderful friends in beautiful places that I can visit when I travel, because I don't stay in motels mm-hmm. and I don't eat at restaurants. So I get to send people a notice as I'm coming. And I visit the Pacific Northwest, which is an area I dearly love, and up on to the San Juan Islands off of the coast of Washington, where 3 of my Climate March elder sister friends live. And I visited them there every year for the last 7 years. And the Southwest, where I have family and friends, and Florida, where I have a brother and a niece. And I love to travel. You know, that supports me in both my climate work and in my need to get out and be with people and do crazy, wonderful things
yeah.
in nature and not. And sure. just in their houses or whatever. I have a broad, deep community of people and family, and I'm very grateful for that. And I think this is true of most people. I have certain people that help provide certain aspects and enrich certain aspects of my life. I have those with whom I have a deep spiritual bond, a deep activism bond, a deep just friendship, good time, let's get together and play.
What does it mean for you to be with people and to travel?
What does it mean to me?
Yeah.
For one thing, it means getting out of Dodge and getting some R&R. Mm. I have a hard time saying no when it comes to doing the work I do. And so leaving town helps me not have to say no and get some R&R, because I can't leave it behind totally because it's in me. But certainly it gives me a chance to recoup, mm-hmm. restore.
I would think that a lot of activists probably experience that feeling, like there's endless work to be done and not knowing how to balance rest in all of that work.
In addition to the Climate March, the Great March for Climate Action, which you can still Google and learn about, and the recent honoring with the climate hero from The Guardian, I was featured in a film called The Race to Save the World, which was made by a guy in California who's a film producer, documentaries, named Joe Gantz. And he made a film about climate activists. And he featured about five or six. And he tells a broad, deep story, personal stories about activists. Mm. And so that was a really fun experience to be featured in that film. And it won some awards. You can still watch it on theracetosavetheworld.org. I was invited to write a chapter for a book called We Rise to Resist, which is a compendium of essays and stories written by 36 activist women that were written shortly after the 2020 election. In reaction to that, and to just talk about what they do and what's important and how they put their energy to work in the world. And I think I'm the only one that wrote about climate. Mm. My climate, but my essay, which was a chapter in this book, We Rise to Resist, is called The Making of a Climate Action Warrior. And it's my story, much of which you've just heard from me today.
Right.
That was a good opportunity for me to put my thoughts together, tell my story, and evaluate and put out what I've learned along the way. And advice I have for people who are going to take that giant step outside their personal comfort zone and take a leap outside the box. When they are inspired, hopefully I can inspire folks. And many others, Greta and so many others, are inspirational. So I'm going to share with you.
Please.
This is from the chapter that I wrote called The Making of a Climate Action Warrior. I won't read the whole thing, of course. I'm just going to give you some highlights of what I've learned along the way. Number one, direct actions speak louder than words. Following the rules doesn't get you any attention. So that's rule number one. It's important to talk. It's important to write those letters to the editor and the opinion pieces and talk and communicate with your friends. That's very important. But actions get more attention. Okay. Mm-hmm. Number two, you cannot do this alone. That's really essential. You need the support of a community to plan together, to work together, to support one another, to pick up the pieces when things and people start falling apart. So find your people. And if you find a group that you think you might be a part of that would support how you feel and it isn't for you, find a different one and look until you find the one that's right for you. And don't find too many, that gets overwhelming. And this was also important. If your heart isn't in an action, don't do it. Find your own niche and don't try to be anybody else. When I give all those 50 speeches or however many, I always say that, be yourself, find out what your purpose and your goal and how that fits into your passion, and do that. You can't be me. I'm already taken.
Right. Yep.
Take regular breaks. I already talked about that one. R&R is really important. Even with good planning and built-in fun and a community of support, the life of a dedicated activist is financially, physically, and emotionally draining. Mm-hmm. We have to maintain a balance in order to keep doing this work. Number five, trust that every failure on the journey leans one step closer to success. Another way of saying that is we never can know what our ripple effects are. And everything we do matters. That's one of my mottos. I use lots of mottos because they're succinct and catchy. And I remember when people tend to remember them.
Yeah.
Everything we do matters, even if you don't get immediate results. And we hardly ever get immediate results. But everything we do matters. And everything we do contributes to eventual success on some level. One of my mottos is we don't lose until we quit. Number six, everything and everyone is connected. And we already talked about that one, mm-hmm. the intersectionality in the interbeing conversation that we had. And maybe this is the most important one. Number seven, remember that we are standing for love and truth and justice. Be the change. We cannot go into this with anger and hatred and nasty, vitriolic behavior towards other people. That won't work. We need to be the change we want to see in the world. We stand for love and truth and justice. So that's what I have learned. All those petals that we talked about contributed to what I just outlined. I've learned other things too, but I think those are the core important ones.
Was there a moment along your journey into being a climate action warrior that you learned about that relationship of the activism you were doing to love and justice?
I think it's always been a part of me, going back to early childhood, Sunday school, whatever. Love and justice and treating people respectfully and has always been a part of me. And certainly when I look at the divisiveness and the fear and the lies and the blame and scapegoating that happens, it just makes it so important that we counter that, which was why the Climate Action Summit was so meaningful to me, where everybody was on an equal footing and felt that palpably in the group. It was really wonderful.
I imagine that you have seen other activists even or other people try to achieve maybe some of the same things you are, but not through love and not through kindness and not through justice. And that might have inspired you even more to lean into that, because I imagine it is also hard sometimes to stay in the love when you're just maybe really frustrated.
This is true. This is true. And none of us are perfect. Certainly I'm not. And I forget my own principles sometimes.
Yeah.
But I always come back to them. And I do my best to live them every day. You know, the random acts of kindness thing is so simple. Mm-hmm. And it can be when you're in the grocery store or walking down the street or in the middle of the front lines doing an action. You know, being kind is really important. I've also learned, which I didn't specifically mention there, I did elsewhere in that chapter, that I don't think we can change people or impress people or inspire people with guilt or blame. Mm-hmm. I don't do that. I think we can inspire by modeling. I mean, I'll frequently talk about how, for example, I think every time I turn on a faucet or switch on a light bulb, I consciously think about how I'm doing it, whether I need to do it, and how long I'll do it. I live that way. Everything I do in my life, I consider the impact it's having on the planet and on other people, because those are intertwined. Mm-hmm. We know climate justice is hitting the least able to deal with it the hardest and fastest. So that's living love.
Yeah.
Turning on a switch thoughtfully is living love.
Mm-hmm. I wonder about those individual actions you're talking about, like how you approach turning on a light switch or recycling or something, like an individual action. I think a lot of people have a hard time. Like you said, climate change and climate action is one of the most important issues, because if we don't have the world, then, you know, none of the other issues can even exist in the first place. But climate is where it really all starts. And I think a lot of people can feel very overwhelmed to the point of just not acting at all, because the forces that it feels like we're quote unquote up against in the fight against climate change are governments and big corporations with money and power. And so I wonder, in addition to the advice you already shared, what advice or perspective do you give to people to help them lean into that personal action in the face of sometimes threats that seem like there's no way to overcome them?
I know that throwing statistics and facts and horror stories about catastrophes is not going to move people off of their numbness or their inaction or their denial or hiding from what's happening. And, you know, those are self-preservation tactics. And I have to do that some of the time as part of remaining, you know, staying in balance. I'll pick up a novel to shut out the world for a while and help me get away. But I always come back. I think that one of the best ways to bring people into the conversation without guilting them or shaming them or leaning on them or making them feel like they're dumb or thoughtless or whatever is invite them to talk about what matters to them. Catherine Hayhoe, she's an evangelical Christian who's also a very notable climate scientist. And she talks about this in her book, about having conversations with people who hold a different view. And she encourages people, just ask, what's really important to you? Well, my kids, my grandkids, you know, whatever. And using that as a starting point rather than the disasters or the scientific facts or the you should be recycling or whatever. So that's one thing that I'm trying to do more of, unless it's not that we can't talk about those other things, but those are not a starting point.
Sure. Well, I imagine that's hard when it's become such a deeply politicized issue, when really it is a human issue.
That's true, but I'm going to also add a caveat to what you just said, Abby.
Okay.
Calling it a human issue is true in terms of cause and effect. But too often when people talk about climate and the catastrophe and extinctions that are happening, you know, over 200 a day in our world, extinctions of plants and animals that nobody even notices they're gone. So I call that an anthropocentric point of view, because most people only talk about the impact on humans. And I'm not saying you did that.
No, that's a great point.
But you reminded me, I always talk about the impact to the global ecosystem, the global environment, and all beings. And for me, that's essential. Because part of our anthropocentric using our Earth as a grocery store is what got us here.
Absolutely.
So when I walked across the country, I noticed the lack of songbirds in the desert and beyond. I noticed hardly any butterflies and so on. I pay attention.
I think that's beautiful, to hopefully inspire people to pay attention. And just thinking about the world of communication studies that I'm in, the perspective that I'm bringing is that we really like to make the distinction between the what and the how of communication. So if the what is the content that's being communicated, then the how is, you know, how it's communicated, the way that it's communicated. And so I wonder, now that you do have this platform to be able to speak and to share your message, how do you approach that? Because the content of what you're saying is so important. And so I wonder what have you found is the most effective way to communicate those ideas, to get people to care and to get people to pay attention, like you said?
Good question. And I think you've been witnessing it. I think the way I do it is the way I've been doing it with you. Mm-hmm. And certainly I also give information, but it depends on the audience. It depends on the audience. But I think telling my stories, because they are powerful stories, I think it awakens something in many people. And it inspires some of them to take a step outside their comfort zone and do something different or do something more or take a risk. When I talk to those kids who were laying on the ground blocking on the climate march, blocking that gate, so the machinery couldn't go out and dig that pipeline, I was frantically opposed to what they were doing. And they demonstrated to me by their actions, and not by telling me I was wrong or I needed to rethink it, but by gently over time giving me examples, talking to me about what they had learned. It changed my mind. I've been arrested 4 times. And here I was berating them for risking that. And I've risked arrest any other number of times. So getting arrested isn't in and of itself a goal.
Right.
But it helps actually to give me a broader platform, because mm-hmm. I can talk about the impact of that, both to me and to what's required before you take those chances. I mean, you mm-hmm. don't just nilly go get yourself arrested.
Right.
That's foolhardy. And I could talk about that for a long time, but this isn't probably the stage for that. But it is an important part of what's happening. You know, how many times did Martin Luther King get arrested? And mm-hmm. and many others. The women who were fighting for the vote for women. You know, just getting arrested gets attention.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell some stories of what it's been like to be arrested?
I was first arrested on the steps of the Capitol in Washington, D.C., which when I was on a climate spring named after the Arab Spring. It was mm-hmm. a march from Philadelphia to D.C. I've been on several marches.
Sure.
Philadelphia to D.C. And we were just sitting there and we were asked to leave by the Capitol Police. And we didn't, because we were there to talk about climate and so forth. So they gently came up and asked us to come up, follow them. And they essentially issued us a ticket, which looks sort of like a parking ticket. And I think it cost $50. And we never were locked up. That was the first one. That was the easiest one. Mm-hmm. I was arrested trying to prevent machinery from digging under the Des Moines River. They were putting the DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, under, drilling under. We were blocking machinery, much like those kids on the march did. And I was arrested there, locked up for a few hours. So somebody gave me my bail, came up with my bail. And this is all prearranged. Mm-hmm. You know, you got this all planned about what can happen, what you're going to do about it. I was in jail for a little while, with locked up with some women. Some of us are still fast friends from being locked up together. Yeah. And paid our bail and went out, had a media event at which I spoke a little bit, and went on our way. We paid our fine. I think it cost me $500 and some. And the next time I was arrested was at Mississippi Stand, where it was very similar. They were starting to drill for the Dakota Access Pipeline under the Mississippi River. And the Mighty Miss is iconic in America culture. You know, it's our national river. And I live not far from the Mississippi River. And I had a cabin for 10 years close to the Mississippi River. And there was a camp in a ditch that came to be called Mississippi Stand that were protesting and trying to block machinery and doing things. It grew and it grew and it grew. And finally, we went up one day, about 100 of us, to where the machinery was. And it was all surrounded by a chain link fence. We went up to try to stop the machinery. If we could stop it for an hour or a day, that's progress. It would cost them a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And legally, if we could get to the machinery, they were legally obligated to stop it, at least temporarily. Well, long story short, I made it close to the machinery and they spotted me and I went to jail. And that time I was also arrested with 30 other people, five of which were members of the 100 Grannies for a Livable Future that I'm active with. And the five of us chose to plead not guilty because we wanted our day in court. Mm-hmm. There's something called the necessity defense that says it was necessary for me to do this because of the threat of this climate catastrophe to our world and to the river and to people everywhere and animals and birds and so forth. And the necessity defense has not really been used much successfully, but we need to keep trying.
Yeah.
Valid. So we pled not guilty. There was a trial date set. We worked with a local lawyer who was working what he called lo bono with us. And we were actually in the car driving down to the county seat down in Southeast Iowa where to meet with the judge for a pretrial hearing. And we got a call from her attorney. He said, turn around and go home. They just dropped the charges. And a lot of people said, yay, you won. But we didn't feel that way.
Right.
Because we wanted our day in court. We wanted the newspapers to talk about these grannies who were trying to protect the Mississippi River and putting their lives and their bodies on the line. So we were disappointed, but we didn't have to pay any fine at least.
That's good. Yeah. But that must be, that's very complex, it seems.
Yeah. So those are some of my arrest stories.
Yeah. So one of the things that I'm thinking of seeing your story through the lens of CMM is that we talk about the patterns that we get ourselves in, that we contribute to create the social worlds that we're in, that ultimately create those social worlds. And so thinking of the narrative of climate change and climate action, I see the pattern we're in right now being one that is fueled by greed and capitalism and hate and fear, probably. And so I wonder, from your perspective, what are the changes that we need to be making to that pattern? How can we start a new pattern for ourselves when it comes to climate activism?
I think that's the question of the hour, Abby. And I don't think there's one answer. I think there are many answers to that question. And I think one of the factors in answering that question is intersectionality, because the answers will look a little different depending on which part of social or climate injustice you're working on. The things that I've been saying and we've been talking about are crucial to answering that. My personal belief is that the bad news gets the press. The crises get the press. The disasters get the press. The wars get the press. But there are so many incredibly wonderful movements happening and technological advances being made and people joining together and rising up to protect the forest where they live or to protect whatever. There's so much happening. And I see that as a part of an entire paradigm shift that we are in the middle of. And this goes, I think, to your question about what needs to change or what do we need to see? Mm-hmm. And I see this. I heard Barbara Marx Hubbard speak years ago. I don't know if you know who she is, but she's a futurist. I don't think she's with us any longer, but I heard her speak probably 30 years ago. And she, as a futurist, she studied history in order to understand paradigm shifts in the history of our planet. And when she talked about a paradigm shift, she said, here's how it looks when a paradigm, meaning the words you use are the social, what was it you called it? The social?
Social world.
Social mm-hmm. world. When that's shifting, the old paradigm or the old social world flares up, hangs on because it's being threatened, and looks bigger and stronger and more powerful than it's ever looked. Meanwhile, over here, the new paradigm or the new social world is emerging. The hopeful things, the incredible advances in people's awareness and willingness to participate in new behaviors, et cetera, et cetera. This is emerging. It doesn't get the press. It isn't near as noticeable as this. And in the middle of that, while this is flaring up and this is slowly emerging, what we see is chaos. And my understanding and observation and belief is that is exactly where we are right now. The old paradigm social world is dying. The new one is emerging, and we are in chaos in the middle. So I think the big question and the big challenge is, we need to do as much as possible so that this can slowly, but not too slowly because we don't have much time, emerge into this new paradigm, this new social world, which is rapidly expanding. I think global consciousness is shifting, but we only hear about this.
Yeah.
And that's why we're talking today. We want
yes,
to talk
yes, it
about
is. Absolutely. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, that is all for our conversation with Miriam. At the end of each episode, I like to offer questions to reflect on, which act as an extern for us, so the conversation doesn't stop just because the episode does. Today, the questions I'd have you think about are, why does it matter how we talk about climate action? And also, how does better language inspire better action? You're welcome to reach out to me to share your reflections, as well as any of your own questions or ideas. You can do that through email, through my website, or by commenting on Instagram and YouTube. And links to all of those places are in the show notes below. The reason I invite you to share your reflections is to stay in dialogue. And other great ways to stay in dialogue include leaving a rating and review of the show, following the show wherever you listen, and most importantly to me, sharing episodes that have been meaningful to you with other people in your life to invite them into the dialogue and invite them to be a part of this community. While I'm resharing this episode as part of the sustainability series, I'll point you back to one other episode that was originally published in December of 2022. That was a real inspiration for this series and for continuing on with this conversation. And that was the two episodes that I have with Aileen, who works in the field of sustainable agriculture. And she's got some really amazing things to say and amazing stories to share. So I'll include links to those in the show notes as well for you to be able to find if you'd like to listen to those episodes again as well. I am supported by the CMM Institute for Personal and Social Evolution, and this podcast is just one of many initiatives designed to create more space for conversations that move us toward better social worlds. A few of the other initiatives of the CMM Institute include the entire Cosmo Activities line of social-emotional resources, which can now be found at www.cosmoactivities.com. We also have a Substack now where you can find all of our resources, including some short educational videos and infographics that I've made, which are great if you're looking to understand CMM a little better and what it really means to take a communication perspective. Again, a link to that will be in the show notes as well. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being curious, and thank you for being a part of this story. I'm Abby, and this has been Stories Lived, Stories Told.